I'd like now to welcome to the program Kristen Canty. She is the producer and director of Farmageddon, The Unseen War on American Family Farms. It's a documentary that's screening tonight at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion. It's part of their ongoing film series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a stunning, fascinating, and I think very important movie about, as you say in the subtitle, the War on American Family Farms. You have your own story of how you started making this movie. What happened?
I do. Well, to start from the very beginning, my son, when he was a preschooler, was allergic to everything. The doctors told me he was allergic to the world and he didn't live in a bubble, practically. He was allergic to grass, dust, every kind of animal, every kind of pollen, bees, and so he used to just scream all night that he couldn't breathe, and he had an asthma inhaler, and doctors kept giving me stronger and stronger medications, and none of the medications were really working to help clear him up, and he was just getting sicker and sicker and wasn't growing. And luckily, to make a long story short, through a lot of research and talking to different naturopath doctors and chiropractors, I took him off the drugs and I started researching nutrition to help him build his immune system up. And after lots of research, I found the Weston Price Foundation, and there were many testimonials on that website about how raw milk could be a cure for allergies. And I was completely against it at the time and disgusted, but the stories were so compelling that I had to try it because my son was so sick and I was at my wit's end, and it seemed to be worth a try. So I found a farmer and asked lots of questions and drank a lot of it myself before I gave it to my son, and lo and behold, about within just a few months, or if not less, he was completely cured. He had no allergies at all. So we just started eating like this for about 10 years. I became a Weston Price chapter leader, which meant that if people wanted to eat right from the farm and learn how to cook traditional foods, they could come to me. And we joined three co-ops. We have a meat co-op and a vegetable co-op and a dairy co-op, and where we just try to get as much food as possible from our farmers. And so about 3-4 years ago, I started reading. I met people from the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund who asked me to have a fundraiser for them, and I didn't know what they did. I helped a lot of farming organizations. So I researched what they did, and I found out that they were defending for free farmers around the country who had been raided. And so I started to research these raids and why farmers would be raided, and lo and behold, it was just people. Farmers that were supplying the same kinds of foods that I ate or drank, raw milk, cream, yogurt, in some cases it was moms, families that started co-ops to share grass-fed beef and pastured eggs and unsprayed veggies from farmers around their area. And I was horrified to find out that our government was trying to shut these operations down and that they were trying to limit our freedom of food choices. And that turned into making a documentary about it. So the movie is, my goal was to give the farmers a voice. I felt like small farmers don't have a voice in this country, and they're very busy farming. And so it's hard for them to have a voice. It's hard for them to speak out. So when these kinds of things happen to them also, because their voice is so suppressed, they feel alone. So my other goal was to, show them that this is happening. This is happening more often than it shouldn't happen at all, but it's happening. These aren't isolated cases anymore either, that this is happening more and more often. And hopefully, when people find out that this is happening, farmers and consumers alike will, get their voices heard and hopefully stop this outrage.
Not only are they being raided for basically very small-scale organic farming, raw milk farming, sometimes having small agricultural cooperatives, things like that, but these raids often happen with SWAT teams at gunpoint, basically kind of terrorist tactics that seem pretty clearly designed to frighten people to the point where they're powerless.
Exactly, right. And these people did feel powerless. Many of them didn't know their rights, that they could have asked for a warrant. In some cases, the warrant wasn't complete. In other cases, there was, the police or the, whatever agent was employed to conduct these raids took more than they were supposed to. So they didn't know their rights. And also, when agents do show up armed, in large amounts and armed with guns, basically, of course, a family with children would do whatever they say. So in every case, in all of the raids, I believe that in some cases there were no charges ever filed. And in every case, I don't think there was ever more than a warrant for a third-degree misdemeanor. So, these raids were conducted to families that harmed no one, to on farms and in people's homes that all of whom had lots of kids there at the time, many of them homeschooled, and these were conducted only for a third degree misdemeanor, which should have been a fine at the most.
So when you send in the SWAT team for a third degree misdemeanor, you're sending a message, and that message is coming from somebody else. No, there were no reports, at least in the film that you made, there was not a single report of anybody having gotten sick or died from food that they were eating from these family farms. But it was rather, apparently, a political message of another kind. Who's behind this, and what's the message they're trying to send?
Exactly. I mean, it was different in every case. In one of the cases at the very beginning, there's a case called Mad Sheep, and that's the story of Linda Falaise and Three Shepherds Cheese up in Warren, Vermont. It was a family that had that imported sheep over from England in order to start a family cheese-making farm, and it was thriving. They were on Martha Stewart. They won awards from Bon Appetit magazine for their excellence in cheese-making. They were on the Today Show, and it was just a very successful small family business. And the USDA decided that there was a chance, because these sheep had come over from England, that the sheep had mad cow disease, or carried mad cow disease, even though sheep never got mad cow disease, and the sheep had tested healthy. They had even tested negative for scrapie. These were very healthy sheep, and even though the test kept coming back negative, in the end, the USDA came in and, in the name of safety, killed all the sheep and actually ended up taking their cheese-making facility down, taking their barn down, and made sure that they could never be in business again. So the people that are carrying out the orders is always different. In some cases, it's been the FDA. In one case, it was the USDA. Sometimes it's the State Department of Agriculture or the state health departments that are conducting these raids. And it's always in the name of food safety. And so, my opinion is that they're really turning their backs on the real food safety problem in this country and going after, the small and artisanal food producers that, have very little chance of making someone sick.
Whereas the problems we've heard with eggs and with spinach and all those kinds of things have actually been from very large producers where there's actually a larger chance of infection, and where they ship their products a much longer distance. And I guess I don't know what kind of regulations have been put in place and how much they've been enforced on big producers, but they seem to be trying to not just enforce safety, but actually put people out of business. That's the part that's really horrifying.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, especially when I think it was either last week or the week before, I saw that Vilsack and the USDA wants to completely deregulate the large chicken slaughtering houses and let them regulate themselves. And they also, in fact, this is completely happening now, where the genetically modified foods, the genetically modified companies, they are completely allowed to regulate themselves. And yet, heavy, heavy regulation right now is coming down on the small farmer. Now, I don't mind, but I have 11 chickens in my backyard, and I have to pay a $50 fee once a year, and an inspector comes out to make sure that my chickens have enough space, that they're well taken care of, that they're fed well, and they have clean water. And the funny thing is that they have enough space because my chickens are free range, and only I eat my eggs. However, the mass producers, you know, the processors that are feeding the masses, the USDA wants to completely deregulate and let regulate themselves. So I just think the discrepancy is bizarre.
Well, it is indeed, and there are real health issues with all of this. I mean, you have your own story of how you cured your child of allergies using raw milk, and raw milk plays a large role in this movie in terms of the people you talk to and what you cover. But there are so many other health issues. Organic food, locally grown food, doesn't lose its nutrients when it's taken over long distances and things like that. And when the USDA was defending its actions on Linda Felice's farm, they basically said that there is no right for humans to be healthy. What was it you have
right.
in your movie?
That was their response, unfortunately, what happened was, that was another case in Athens, locally grown. A co-op that was bringing in milk from South Carolina and selling it in Georgia. And the FDA and the Georgia Health Department came in and confiscated all the milk and made them dump it. And so their response and the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund's response was to sue the FDA for not allowing milk to cross over state lines. And the FDA's response, you know, the FDA asked for that suit to be dropped. And their response to that was that you don't have the right to bodily health and you don't have the right to consume the foods of your choice. And so an agency that will actually make the statement that you don't have the right to bodily health, that's in charge of our health or thinks they're in charge of our health, I think that's quite frightening.
So do we have evidence? Do you have evidence? Because it's not really talked about that much in the movie. Who is behind the movement, in other words, if it's a lobbying group, or who's the political power behind this attack on small family farms?
Well, one of the main people right now, person that's defended the raids outright and publicly, is Michael Taylor. And Michael Taylor worked for Monsanto for a number of years, and he wrote a paper that said that bovine growth hormones were safe for human consumption. And then he went to the FDA, and he approved his own paper. And he worked there for a while trying to make it so that we never knew that bovine growth hormones were in our milk. He went back to the FDA, and now he is food safety chief. And he is publicly defending these raids on farms. And he and the current administration and all the administrations, this is the Democratic and Republican administrations. Both of them have played a part in this. Are saying that we don't have the right for our food to be labeled. We don't have the right to know that there's genetically modified foods in our food. We don't have the right, we don't have the right to know what we're eating. We don't have the right to know that chemicals are in our food. And that's a problem.
And all of those things seem to only apply to large-scale agribusiness. I mean, those same things that you're saying, seems to be exactly the opposite for small-scale farming.
Right, exactly the opposite. So if you want to be an organic farmer and you want to grow your food in just soil and water, you need to fill out an incredible amount of paperwork in order just to prove that you're only growing in soil and water, nothing else. As soon as you decide to throw chemicals on your food, you're exempt from that paperwork. You don't have to fill any out.
That's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. It truly is. What I found out in my research in this movie was I never stopped getting blown away. So, and you know what? The organic farmers, they want to be transparent, and you want to know if you really want organic food and you want to know what's in your food. And then, for the most part, they don't resent that as much as they resent the fact that if you throw chemicals on your food, you don't need to label that. That's more resentful than they're having to fill out the paperwork. The fact that if they just sprayed, you know, with pesticides, that they wouldn't have to do this at all.
We're talking to Kristen Canty. She is the producer and director of the film Farmageddon, The Unseen War on American Family Farms, which, by the way, is screening tonight at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion at 7 o'clock. Now, there are also some other issues that are raised by this movie, and one of them is the right that people have to share food with each other. So there are cases of people who are basically neighbors who are trading food and giving stuff back and forth to each other, and that is also falls under the purview of, first of all, regulation and also raids and SWAT teams and guns and all that stuff.
It does now, and unfortunately, you know, we've seen this happening more and more often, that kids aren't allowed to sell lemonade on their corners, the lemonade stands are getting shut down, church potlucks are getting shut down. My museum, a museum in my town down the street, they've always had, whenever they have speakers, all, you know, women, people from the different neighborhoods come in, you know, neighborhoods surrounding the museum come in. We have potluck. We all make something and bring something in. And our health department's shutting that down. Now we can't have potlucks. I've heard of farm-to-fork dinners being shut down. People, you know, just serving food off their farm and having a large dinner. I've heard of health departments coming in and pouring bleach on the food, on simple farm-to-fork neighborhood dinners. And so, you know, we just hear this time and time again. An example in my movie is the Omana Storehouse in Ohio. This woman found 40 Amish farms around her that had no way to get their product to market. So she had this great idea, which was to go around to these different farms and get their produce and eggs and meat and bring it back to her house one day. And then the next week, another neighbor would do it. And so they, you know, it got bigger and bigger. So more and more neighbors came in and they would share the transportation and everybody would be able to pick their food up at one location once a week. You know, it's a co-op. It was a private club. It was private between them. And this was one of the cases where as many as 11 armed agents came in. She had 8 kids in the house, and they kept all the kids in a room for 6 hours while they tore her house apart, took her food that for her private consumption, took her food for her co-op, took their computers, took their cell phones, and terrorized them for 6 hours. And that was for a third-degree misdemeanor.
It seems to me, again, watching this and being in a state and a city that really supports its farmers markets, that what they're doing is the exact opposite of the direction we need to go. I mean, just on the level of health care costs, I mean, you saved your insurance company or the state probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of lifetime costs by, illness costs by curing your baby of allergies using raw milk. Okay, when you think about the kind of junk that is available at, oh, let's say, art openings or those events that aren't potlucks, but the stuff they put out, which is just basically junk food. I mean, not everybody, you know, with great respect to our healthy, but, you know, when you go in public and there's available food, or if you go to a conference and there's breakfast on the table for you to eat, most of it is really bad for you. And so basically what they're saying is we want Americans to eat food that is bad for them.
Exactly. Right. I wouldn't get in trouble, or none of these co-ops would get in trouble if they were going to McDonald's and bringing back McDonald's to their house and sharing that. So, you know, and it would be fine for me as a mother to feed my kids, you know, sugary cereal in the morning, processed foods for lunch, and some kind of a boxed or microwave thing for dinner. That is completely acceptable. And if my child got sick, or, you know, allergies or diabetes or cancer or any of the, you know, diseases that are rampant right now today in our society, you know, it wouldn't be my fault. However, if a child even sniffles if they drink raw milk, then people get into a lot of trouble.
There's some wonderful people in your film, and there's a lot of beauty in your film. There's a guy whose name I can't remember now, who moves his flock from place to place on his field in a way that both fertilizes the field and gives his poultry fresh food every day. And he does all of this completely manual labor, ultra super healthy. I think it's probably a biodynamic farm. No inputs from the outside at all, just using the farm to nourish itself.
Right. That's Jill Salatin that you're speaking about. And he was featured prominently in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. And he's also been in Food, Inc. And he has a big role in the movie Fresh. Fresh, the movie, also a great movie. And he has, his farm in a Swoop, Virginia, where he just pastures all of his animals. He's also written 5 books on the subject. And he's been traveling around the country speaking extensively on this issue, on how, he'll tell you the story of health department agents driving onto his farm, telling him that his birds, because they were outdoors, were a biohazard, where he has, factory chicken farms all over near him. And they were worried about his outdoor birds because they were, he says, communing with their, cousins flying around, and they could get bird flu and then give bird flu to everyone. And, at the time when this happened, he was able to tell them to get off their property. At this time, the FDA has been taking on an awful lot of power, and I don't know if he'd be able to tell them to get off their property, his property, anymore. The fact that these health departments think that our free-range birds are a biohazard, and birds that are just crowded and knee-deep in their own excrement, and fed bakery waste, is perfectly fine. It's just a travesty. But Joel Salatin is he's very funny in the movie, and when you hear him speak, you just get it. It that you want pastured meat, you want pastured eggs, and he has a nice way about him. So if anyone has a chance to read any of his books, he just came out with a new one called Folks, This Ain't Normal.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I was watching the movie, and also when you're talking, is like, and actually one guy says it, it's like, don't we remember, he goes, I wouldn't be here without raw milk, and you're wondering whether, raw milk cured disease, but he's like, all my ancestors drank raw milk since the beginning of milk production, and it's like, don't we remember where we come from? I mean, our ancestors may have gotten some illnesses, but they pretty much survived in a healthy way on decent raw food.
Right. And my movie isn't in any way to say that raw milk is going to cure all your ills. It doesn't work for everybody. Some people, can still only stomach milk if it's fermented in kefir and yogurt. And some people can't tolerate milk at all. And sometimes they'll find the health and nutrition in other lacto-fermented vegetables or kefir water or fermented coconut water. But however, there's a myriad of different ways that we can get our nutrition. And for me, the raw milk helped, and I'm eternally grateful. But the movie just really wants to, in the movie, I just try to stress our freedom. Our freedom to choose the people that produce our food, to choose the places that we want to get our foods from, and to be able to choose unprocessed foods if we so wish for our own bodies.
Is there a political movement that people can latch on to?
Oh, there's so many organizations. The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is defending the farmers for free, and the Weston A. Price Foundation is a nutritional foundation that teaches people how to eat in traditional ways. There's the Organic Consumers Association, which is fighting very hard for the labeling of foods and for our right to drink raw milk. The Weston Price Foundation does that also. The Farm to Consumer Foundation, fights for helping farmers get their food to market. The Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance out of Texas fights for freedom in farming. In the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, there's all different chapters of that. So, luckily farmers are banding together to try to, to try to have a voice, and we need more and more.
Well, all of those, or many or most of those links are on your website, which is PharmageddonMovie.com, and you can look under resources and what's at stake. And the film screens, once again, tonight at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. It's a wonderful film, and despite all the horror that we're talking about, it's a beautiful and funny and fascinating film. So I encourage people to go see it, and thank you, Kristen Canty, for making it.
All right. Thank you so much.
And for more information on the film, you can go to SantaFeFarmersMarket.com. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a few minutes. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Aaron Levantman and Stephen Jules Rubin. They are both taking part in Santa Fe's monthly variety show produced by Jules Works. It's this Friday, April 27th at 7 o'clock at the Warehouse 21 Black Box Theater. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you are producing this partly as a way of just getting your work out.
Yeah, it's double. It's a means for getting our own work out, hence Jules Works. But, you know, there's been some push to do something, but I didn't want it to be all Jules Works and, you know, bore the audience and have it be so much work that we have to do. So it's that. It's something to get me, you know, active. But also the variety show is meant to, you know, be a showcase for the community artists for all kinds of art. So it's open each month, starting this month, for, you know, anybody who has any kind of thing that they think would be good in it. So I think that's a chance for new artists to present material and artists that are established to try something different, you know, or new material, whatever.
Now, Aaron, you are a writer, you're a playwright, and I read your play, which is good. It's called Maturity. It's about two fraternal twins, a boy and a girl, and a variety show like this is a way to get a short play out there. It's sort of like getting a short film out there.
Right. It's a great, what's great about variety shows is the sort of mixed media aspect to it, that you have a little bit of theater, a little bit of music, and people that are interested in different things can enjoy it. But I think definitely it's always a challenge, not just in Santa Fe, but I think in the world, to get original work produced. And, you know, I've been able to get some stuff done, you know, around the country, in New York and different places, but it's always helpful for the writer, you know, to see your work performed by actors. I think when you're just locked into your own head, when you're at your computer, you don't get the same kind of life that you do when you see it up on the stage. So it's great to have the opportunity that Stephen's providing for all of us.
When you start directing and you've got your actors doing it, did you, in that process, modify the play at all?
Well, the play's been done before, and it's always modified a little bit. And the two actors I'm working with, Maureen Dolan and Galen Hutchison, who we met during Benchwarmers, we were working on Benchwarmers together this year, bring their own personalities and their own ideas to it. And so it sort of alters by itself without me doing anything.
Right.
They bring their own intentions, and everything's a little different when you use different actors each time. Their energy is very different. I did certainly, this time I didn't change a whole lot because it's been done before. I felt like it was already set, but it changes just by having different people do it by itself. And it's really fun to see the different versions of it each time it's put on. And it's always like a surprise to me.
Yeah. Now, Stephen, yours is, I guess you would say, a kind of wacky comedy?
Yeah, wacky comedy meant to, it's not slapstick, and if there are slapstick moments, you know, I'm hoping, even though I don't necessarily understand the meaning of what's there, that it's there. And in the past, I've always been glad that, you know, all sorts of different people will say, oh, I love that part, oh, I really identified with this character, this line, and that's male, female, young, old, tend to find something. So that's awesome. And a lot of times, you know, the thing that somebody likes best, you had no idea, you know. So that's great. And then the one that I'm directing that Trent Zelazny wrote is fantastic. And all the actors, it's three actors, they, you know, are all have been as we met week after week. That one's required a lot of rehearsal. You know, wow, I didn't realize how much subtext there is. And I joke that Trent probably didn't either when he wrote it.
When you're writing a comedy, when you're directing and doing a comedy, again, there's always the question of how you hear it and then how the audience is going to hear it. Do you get audience in there who are fresh to see if they laugh at the parts that you think are the good lines?
You mean in the rehearsal process?
Yeah.
Not usually. I think when I was doing more feature stuff, we used to, and you know, some great people in town, Godfrey Reggio used to come in, and so it would be great when you can get, and you know, have done a couple of readings for potential feature films, and so when you can get other people in, it's great. You know, that's a balance of whether you want to share the material or not. You know, it's probably a good idea, and especially, it's interesting to think about it, for a one-night thing, you know, because when you're going to do it repeatedly, you know you'll get that, and each night it may evolve, but with one night, that's your shot, I guess.
Yeah, and it's one night. It's this Friday, the 27th of April at 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21. Now, there's another piece by Lila Dawkins, On the Road with Amy Vanderbilt. Sounds
right.
Promising.
Yeah, and she's going to do that and the little Jules Works thing are meant to be serialized each month, so she's presenting the first piece of this one-woman show, which she had tried to get produced as an entire piece, so this was a great way for her to do it, you know, to get it done, but in segments. And she had sent me the script, but I didn't want to read it because on the producer side of what I'm doing, I'm not meaning to control anyone's content so much as just length can be important, you know,
right,
for putting together the show and not being too long.
So what, they're all about 20-minute pieces, something like that?
Mine's about 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, I think they're all about that. And then in between each, there'll be short numbers, you know, spoken word, music, things like that. And we also have a host who's going to, you know, provide a continuity. And
who's the host?
The host is Elena Zachary.
Oh, great.
We're lucky to have her.
She's fabulous.
Yes.
She's a great actress and a great person.
And see, one thing with the variety show that I'm intending and should hopefully work is the more, you know, different people, different kinds of stuff, different ages, different connections, hopefully the bigger the audience, you know, and the appeal.
And so if you're doing a serialized thing, then they come back the next month.
Yeah, so somebody comes and identifies, and I think Aaron has hopefully different shows to do too, but identifies with a certain work and may not like a certain piece. They'll know it's going to end and there'll be something different, you know. So.
And excellent. I think, you know, getting back to what you were talking about, you know, comedy and people's reactions, it's just... From my experience, it's always never what you think it's going to be. People tend to laugh at things that you don't think are funny, and then people don't laugh at things that you think are really funny.
I know.
And it, you know, it is true that this is a one night, so you don't get to see, to change things or to have it evolve. But I think that's kind of what makes it kind of special. It's like a, you know, one night only, you know, unique experience. The people that were there that particular night get to see something that no one else will get to see.
Yeah.
Again, so.
And Leela's show, you know, it's humor, but it's not just stand-up. You know, she's got content there too, and then so also, you know, there's that, and Aaron's is a lighter comedy, I think, with some drama.
I would say it's a drama with some sort of comic aspects to it, but it's actually it's a little dark, but I think people will laugh because they'll relate to the sibling rivalry and a lot of the issues that come up. You know, for me, the idea to do the play came about growing up in a sort of unrestrictive, upper-middle-class, liberal family where we kind of had free rein to do whatever we wanted to, and the sort of issues that come up as you're trying to figure out whether you're still a kid or an adult in that summer between high school and college, and that anxiety as to, you know, who am I? And so I think people will hopefully relate to that part of it. And there's
some who am I in the Jules Works piece and Trent's piece, which is... to be the first of the second act is not funny. So that definitely couldn't be the end of the show. So then ending with the wacky Jules Works thing, I think we'll, you know, have audiences leave a little more upbeat.
You are writing, directing, producing. Everybody is doing a little bit of everything, and that's the way it is when you do a homemade, home-produced variety show.
Yeah.
Low budget, exactly. And you come from New Mexico's once burgeoning film industry, where you used to be with the Santa Fe Film Festival, which has gone through many mutations or evolutions, I guess, since then. But how does it, I mean, do you have to like all the different parts of that process? Would you prefer to be doing just one of them?
Well, the one that hopefully someday won't have to much do is the producing, you know, which by default, you know, continue to have to do. And I haven't really done a whole lot outside of trying to push my own performing as an actor for quite a while, because of the stress of the producing and putting this show on, even though it's one night, it may seem like not much, you know, I'm learning that again, particularly with no budget, because somebody feels overworked or, you know, a technician gets offered something, needs to be at the Lensic, and all of a sudden we're left alone. I don't know how to do the light board, you know, different things that are just so crazy stressful. As an actor, you come in and do your thing and, you know, you take the material, interpret it, interact with your partner, do what the director says, ignore what the director says, and then you go home and hope they do the best. Whereas all these other components, and it's interesting doing theater and film, and when we first started doing plays long ago, people would say, that was very cinematic, and how much theater have you actually ever seen? Why are you doing theater instead of film? And that was 15 years ago or so, and over those years, pretty quickly, with the technology of cameras, at the time it was cheaper and easier to stage any kind of play. Now it's, you know, probably cheaper to put on. You can make a great film for less than dealing with, you know, all these rehearsals and the stage, the theater rentals and all that stuff.
Right, once you've bought your camera and Final Cut Pro.
Yeah, I mean, you can do so much. Get a young kid to edit the whole thing for you. And I mean, yeah, the options are really great with digital. Luke Fitch, my buddy, just got a Red camera. You know, he's built a green screen studio.
He's fabulous.
So, yeah, he's great. So I love theater and this opportunity. You know, film is much more of a passion, and writing, directing, and acting. For the first time the past couple of years, I have been able to answer that question that my primary preference is acting. But, you know, and Aaron?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I came from a film background. I was trained to write screenplays, and I think when I write plays, they're very short scenes, and they're still very cinematic. And the last director I worked with in New York was saying, I wish there was a way that we could somehow make these really short scenes work differently in a play, because, you know, they do film, you have that advantage to be able to cut very quickly to the next location. In theater, it actually works better when you expand one particular scene more than have very short scenes. At least that's been my experience, and of course anything can work, but for me, doing both theater and film, I sort of like the community aspect of doing theater a lot more. That film is, a lot of it is so much about the production elements and the budget and the technical elements. And in theater, you really get to work with characters and work with people directly. And for me, it's more creative. And I think I hear what you're saying, Stephen, about that it's so easy, not easy, but it's easier than it used to be to get a budget together and equipment to make a film. But I found for me it was much easier to get a play produced than to sell a screenplay.
Yeah.
Which
right.
seemed to be like
and the business and
ridiculous.
Technical of film can definitely overwhelm
yeah.
the creative, and you feel
yeah.
like you've got 1% of creative that you're doing and 99% of all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Theater definitely has that live, you're mm-hmm. out there, you know.
Mm-hmm. So the event, Santa Fe's monthly variety show, is this Friday at 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21 in the Black Box Theater. That's the one downstairs?
That's the upstairs.
Oh, that's
yeah,
the upstairs yeah. one. Okay.
It's terrific. And Warehouse is so great.
Warehouse is wonderful. Big shout out and kudos to Warehouse 21. And so can we really expect this to be once a month?
Yeah, I mean, we're booked with the dates through summer. So, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll get enough people for it to keep growing. And I hope enough people will attend and realize that they should submit their work, and it keeps
growing.
Well,
that's what I was going to ask you. You're,
yeah.
you're opening it up to people who want to submit work and be either a one-off or in an ongoing way part of a monthly variety show.
Yeah, it's just, you know, see me there, find me around, email me, and you know, whichever month it can work, you know, I want to try to involve. And it can, I would hope some dance will come up, maybe some multimedia, you know, the options at Warehouse are big. It's a big, not even really stage, just a big space.
You can easily show films there, too.
Yeah, there's a
short
screen.
Films they want to show.
You know, if somebody
right.
wants to come out and do some crazy cabaret number or something, you know.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to seeing you at Warehouse on Friday at 7 o'clock. And Aaron Levitman and Stephen Rubin, thank you both so much for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for your support always.
And we're going to take another little break right now. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Susan Longhenry. She's the director of the Harwood Museum of Art in Taos. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're just passing through Santa Fe, and we don't have that many chances to talk to people from Taos. Every once in a while we do. And the Harwood Museum is very much of a destination, and it's a place that's changed quite a lot lately.
It really has. It's the second oldest museum in the state of New Mexico. I'm not sure how many people know that, but we will celebrate our 90th anniversary next year in 2013. Yeah. So it's really kind of interesting, because it was formed, the Harwood Foundation was formed by Lucy Harwood in 1923, and she was joined by Taos Society of Artists, artists Bert Phillips and Victor Higgins. So when you really think about the Taos Society of Artists, you really should be thinking about the Harwood Museum of Art as well, because we're really part of that story. But indeed, it has grown tremendously just in the past few years. We had an expansion in December 2010 that added a beautiful new gallery, the Mandelman Reebok Gallery, and a 130-seat auditorium that just really has transformed the place. So
now, is that one of those HD auditoriums?
It is. It's got surround sound. It's got high-definition projection. It's really just a fantastic space. I feel like when you go in there, like you're in a space shuttle or something. It really kind of transports you through some of the great things that happen in there. So,
and it's the second HD auditorium in Taos.
It is. There's also Taos Center for the Arts, which does different types of programming. But we do films, we do jazz concerts, we really do a lot of wonderful things there that, you know, it's only an hour and a half away. It's an easy drive up there,
well,
so
I
we'd
know.
Love it. We'd love to see some Santa Fe people up there.
Well, and there's a lot of people who listen to this show who live partway between Santa Fe and Taos, or who live in Taos or in the surrounding hills. And what kind of exhibitions do you have going on, and what do you have planned?
This is a fantastic time to come to the Harwood, because we have a really wonderful exhibition called Agnes Martin Before the Grid, which is our clever way of saying that the Harwood actually is very well known for the Agnes Martin Gallery, which is a permanent installation of seven Agnes Martin grid paintings that surrounds you in a really wonderful octagonal space. But she had a body of work that she worked on for 20 years before that is very, very little known. And so this exhibition explores that work, biomorphic. It's work from maybe the late 1940s to the early 60s. So it really sheds a lot of light on the work of Agnes Martin. I think helps you understand how she came to where she wound up with those grids, which I think, you know, a lot of people walk into that magical gallery and there are one of two reactions. One is that they fall to their knees and they're just immediately meditating, or they look at it and say, okay, what is this? So
right.
I think it really helps to see the artist's journey, what she worked through for the 20 years before that Agnes Martin Gallery
happened. You should go to the grids and then the before the grid and then back to the grids.
You should, and see how you look at the grids differently.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly what we try to do at the Harwood, is to have conversations with art and artists, and that's up through June 17th. This is... she would have been 100 years old on March 22nd, so we had a big birthday party for her up in Taos.
Wow.
and a big symposium.
She had a very long life.
She did. She lived until she was 92. She died in 2004 in Taos at the, what was the known as Plaza de Retiro, it was known as.
Yeah.
So she, it's interesting because she's such an internationally prominent artist, but she was a person who just tooled around Taos in her, you know, in her cars, everybody knew, with the Hillary Clinton bumper sticker on it. So kind of where the person and the legend meet is what this exhibition is about. And that's been pretty, you know, for the Harwood, I mean, it's pretty exciting to be able to deliver that kind of experience.
Now, who are the people who come to the museum? Does it tend to be mostly people from out of town who know that that's one of the destinations you're supposed to go to, or do a lot of New Mexicans go?
Both, actually. We get a lot of people who come from all over the country, especially, to be honest, to see that Agnes Martin Gallery. In fact, I think our fifth most popular zip code is New York. So we draw a lot of people who know a lot about the Taos Society of Artists, who want to see our paintings, the Victor Higgins, the Bert Phillips, the Bloom and Shine. But also, I think we're known as the place where if you like Agnes Martin, you need to come experience that Agnes Martin Gallery.
Right.
But we have a lot of people from Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and it's really just, it's a very easy day trip, and it can be a fun getaway.
And my favorite pizza place is there, if it's still there, Outback.
Oh, of course. Yes.
It's
good. It's fantastic. It's a big, it fills you up, that's for sure. So you may remember that, but
yes.
I'm thrilled to be in Taos.
So we're talking to Susan Longhenry, director of the Harwood Museum of Art in Taos. How are you celebrating your centennial?
Well, it's the centennial of course, the state of New Mexico, but it happens to be the centennial of two pretty amazing artists who live in Taos. One of them was Agnes Martin, but the other
was... Oh, that's right. You guys are 90 years old.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll be 90 years old next year. But Beatrice Mandelman is another artist who moved here from New York in the 40s, about the same time that Agnes Martin first came to Taos. And Beatrice came out here with her husband, Louis Reebok, and she actually came out here, and they thought about checking into Santa Fe, and that was at the recommendation of the artist John Sloan, who many people will know. That was one of his teachers, and they found Santa Fe too congested. So they actually, they wound up in Taos and moved there in the 40s and stayed there until they both passed away. But Beatrice Mandelman will be celebrating her centennial with an exhibition this summer, rather two of them, one of collage work. She worked a lot in collage, and another very different of social realist prints. So that's going to be, I think, a really another fun celebration of an artist who lived in Taos, was a really pretty remarkable woman. We've got this collaboration going on with the town about the remarkable women of Taos.
Yes, we did a show on that recently with
Kathy Connolly,
and Sheree Burns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, there were some pretty rowdy women who lived up in Taos, and, you know, Beatrice was somebody who was hitchhiking to Mexico in the 40s with her friends. And
right.
So it's, but...
I find it continually irritating that there are all these amazing women artists who are finally getting a show that no one's really ever heard of, and in their day they were just as famous as the male artists around them, but they didn't quite make it into art history. I hope that changes.
Well, I think that's certainly part of this initiative.
Yeah.
You know, that they always say Anonymous was a woman, right? I mean, it's...
Well, yeah, but I mean, who's ever heard of Beatrice Mandelman?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's something that Harvard can do, is really shed some light on artists who worked in Taos and did amazing work, and I think people would enjoy seeing those shows.
So the HD phenomenon is really big here. We've got all kinds of operas and plays from the Royal Theatre in London and all that kind of stuff. What kind of shows are you doing up there?
We do all kinds of things, and it's just so cool because you can be there in Taos, New Mexico, and for example, we do simulcasts of the lectures from the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan, and it's just so fun. It's just a little thrill to sit in the audience, and they'll say at the beginning, "Welcome to Harwood Museum of Art in Taos, New Mexico," and you can submit questions. But they have, for example, Madeleine Albright is coming up as one of our 92nd Street Y speakers. That'll be coming next month. So that for me has been pretty exciting, to have that kind of intellectual dialogue, even if you're just watching, access to this kind of experience. But we also do a lot with the Bolshoi Ballet, so you can sit in Taos and pretend you're in Russia. They do simulcasts of their ballets that we work with. We've done the Paris Opera House. So
those are two amazing things. They did a Bolshoi thing at the Lenzik a couple of years ago, and it made you cry.
It
was so good.
Yeah. No, it really does transport you, and I think just the power of technology. I mean, I remember when technology first came out, people were worried that it was going to be all about the machines and not about people. But this is what it does, is it brings people together, and it brings these amazing experiences to you. So
the Harwood Museum of Art, ladies and gentlemen, is pretty easy to find. It's just
we're right by the plaza.
Yeah. You're right in the center of town.
Ladue Street's right off the plaza, so if you get there and just head a little bit south, you'll find us.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Susan Long-Henry is the director of the Harwood Museum, and come back next time you're in Santa Fe.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Excellent.
Okay.